Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Families across the state of New York, like those nationwide, are dealing with a variety of stressors, from the back and forth of food stamp cuts to complications surrounding federal assistance for heating to this month's expiring Affordable Care Act subsidies. Federal resources in limbo. The New York State Office of Children and Family Services hopes to fill that gap by redirecting people to state-funded resources that are still available. The Legislative Gazette's Sagina Shrestha spoke with the office's commissioner, Dr. Demia Harris-Madden, about what benefits are available for New Yorkers.
So, you know, let's start with the community supports that we have. OCFS operates the HEARS line, which is the Help, Empower, Advocate, Reassure, and Support. And I don't know that enough New Yorkers know that this HEARS line is available to them Monday through Friday in 12 different languages. I want to underscore the fact that HEARS is truly for resources and supports. It's not to be confused with our statewide, you know, child abuse registry, right? So we want to make that distinction, because this helpline, which we call HEARS, is really just to connect families to the resources to ensure that they're able to navigate, because it's very confusing depending on where you live, what resources, i.e. food banks, i.e. child care supports, where are these resources located. So the HEARS line is really important to underscore here. We also invest a lot in some of the, you know, community local nonprofits. We believe grassroots organizations are the strength of our communities. And so, for example, parenting supports are really in demand at this time. We want families to know that OCFS has established an abandoned infant helpline, which is 1-866-505-SAFE. Again, 1-866-505-SAFE, so that they can receive information and referrals to suitable locations to leave their child if it comes to that. We hope it does not. In the meantime, we also, through our HEARS line, will connect families to resources all throughout New York State so that it never gets to a point where one is abandoning their child.
Speaking about resources that one deserves and needs, has the federal climate impacted any funding streams and operations for the office? And how are you anticipating operations for the upcoming budget cycle?
Well, no doubt we have to tighten our belts, right? And I am thankful, as of this conversation, we have not been adversely impacted by funding cuts specific to OCFS. However, the adjacent sister agencies, right, and services have been impacted. And so therefore it impacts us, right? So an example is when you're looking at individuals, for example, that have had waivers in foster care as they aged out and have been able to receive certain benefits because they are unable to work. That is an example of where OCFS, although we do not administer TANF funding, it impacts the population we serve. And so now some of those young people who have aged out of foster care and who would have normally had a waiver that allows them to not work while they're unable, right, are going to be forced to go into the workforce. Why is that a concern for us? Many of our young people that have experienced extreme trauma and or may have some level of disability may not be prepared to work. And obviously, we want our young people to be self-sufficient. We want them contributing to society, but we also need them prepared because employers need employees that are prepared, right? They need those soft skills and technical skills to be able to perform the job. And so it concerns me that we now have, you know, a situation where many of our young people that have been transitioned out of foster care that are still trying to find their way will be thrust into, you know, the either seeking employment or the workforce ill-prepared. So that's one example of where, you know, we see some challenge.
I see. And with that in mind, what should families anticipate and expect in the upcoming year with everything that's happening when it comes to accessing resources from OCFS?
We want them to contact our HEARS line. This way they can be connected to the appropriate resources that are available. HEAP does not flow through OCFS, neither does TANF funding, right? Medicaid funding does not. So we want to be able to be that connector so families can call our HEARS line and then be connected to the appropriate resources. I mean, there's so many things that are out there that the governor has also placed in her budget that will not be impacted by the federal action. So, for example, the governor introduced a new birth allowance for, you know, the beginning year. It's called the baby benefit, which is a one-time payment of $1,800 to low-income parents receiving public assistance once their child is born, right? So this helps to cover essentials like diapers and clothing and, you know, other things that newborns need. So that is not going to be interrupted because our governor has put this in place. I mentioned before the child tax credit, which is, you know, the largest increase we've seen in this program in history. So we anticipate more than, you know, 1.5 million families will be eligible to claim up to $1,000 per child. So these are the types of resources and knowledge exchange that OCFS is happy to provide through our HEARS line and looking to our website. Again, I talked about the many different avenues to address some of the greater risk factors.
Thank you so much for this conversation, Damia. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
That's the Legislative Gazette's Sagina Shrestha speaking with the Commissioner of New York State's Office of Children and Family Services, Dr. Damia Harris-Madden. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Michelle Haddon, Executive Director of the New York Council on Problem Gambling, to talk about expanded gambling in New York and its impact on gambling addiction.
If you think about it, David, the way that we primed our young people right from, you know, 3-4 years old, right, of mystery boxes at the stores, right? Like my son's 15 now. When he was coming out, the big thing was, you know, that you would go and buy these mystery boxes and you would open them. You don't know what was going to be in it for a surprise. And we started at such a young age, even with them watching other people online doing activities, right, and getting excited by that through our phones, through our apps. We've really set up that mechanism early on in their brains to be, you know, rewarded for these high excitement activities that really are no effort to them either, right? You pick up your phone, you hit a button, right? It's not the same as like when we used to go outside and have to like, you know, become an athlete and work hard at it. And then you're taking healthy risks. These are risks that are just so, there's just no energy or effort that's being put into it. And their brains are not fully developed for higher level judgment. So they're just set up to be much more at risk even when they head into this type of activity than adults are, right? And so then, you know, as they move towards, you know, becoming of legal age, their brains still aren't fully developed until they're 24, 25 years old. So I'm 18 years old and now I can gamble on certain things, right? And I am not still fully developed to be able to do that, you know, or 21 even, right? Because we're not fully brain developed until 24 or 25. So what we're seeing is, you know, a lot of these college age, you know, 18 to 24 range students who are really preliminary data is showing us that they are at moderate to high risk of developing a problem with gambling. And we know from studies that were done by University of Albany in 2024 that about 45.5% of college students are gambling already. You know, they're involved. And so we're highly concerned about that population, and we're doing some work to try to assess what's happening on campuses in New York State and move forward from there with plans to start to mitigate some of this and make sure students are educated, aware of the risks, because not only, you know, is it high-risk population in general, but then you add in student athletes, you add in, you know, people who are already struggling with mental health issues or substance use issues, and we see high co-occurring rates of gambling problems alongside marijuana use and tobacco use and alcohol use in that population as well. So, you know, they're bigger issues than just I'm doing fantasy sports or I'm placing a bet here or there. You know, it's something with this particular population we want to be really mindful of, the fact that they're just not wired yet to make good decisions around this.
Yeah, and when you talk about this particular youth population in gambling, I believe you were referencing You Decide NY, right? Isn't there a special service there that you have, youdecideny.org, where younger people can get help?
Absolutely. So that's one of our grants here at the New York Council on Problem Gambling. And the focus of that is for young people to become educated, for parents, community influencers, anyone who's working with youth. There are a tremendous amount of resources on that website. And, you know, as you said, youdecide.org. And we are, you know, always at the council here to provide additional support. We have both treatment programs. We have one-to-one peer support services. We work with a company called GAMFIN to provide financial counseling to anyone in New York State who needs it. So a plethora of services available regardless of age, but definitely available for this age group as they're starting to identify, you know, again, gambling harms they might be experiencing.
That's Michelle Haddon, Executive Director of the New York Council on Problem Gambling. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. In November, Republican Attorney Kurram Darah threw his hat in the ring to be his party's nominee to take on New York Attorney General Letitia James, a Democrat vying for a third term. The former financial regulatory lawyer spoke with Public Radio's David Lombardo on the Capitol Press Room about his vision of a scaled-back state attorney general's office.
Well, if you were the attorney general of New York for the last 11 months, would you have not brought any of the lawsuits that stemmed from instances where the Trump administration was withholding federal funds from New York? Would you have said, we're out of luck? I guess that's the policy.
No, I would not say, you know, all or nothing. I would view each one on a case-by-case basis. What my problem with the way in which RAG and state AGs across the country engage in multi-state litigation is it's reflexive. It's almost like, well, if the president happens to be in the opposing party, then we're going to always line up and we're going to be always in a block together.
Sure, but what about the instances I'm talking about? I mean, this could have cost the state hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in funding if the state attorney general of New York is not successful in these lawsuits.
I think cases where there's money that New York is supposed to be getting and it's being withheld for some unlawful reason, that's a perfectly acceptable reason for the AG to step up and say, hey, you know what, we think that we need to lead a multi-state coalition, or we just need to bring a challenge ourselves. My point is that far too often, this appears to be highly partisan. And I would actually have a presumption against jumping into multi-state litigation where it is only other people in the same party as me joining the coalition. I just think it leads people to have declining trust in the way the office is being used.
So we want to come back to that idea of the role of the office and affordability and the scope of the office, because there's a bill that's awaiting the governor's signature right now that was championed by the state attorney general, and it's designed to be a consumer protection measure that would address, among other things, online phishing scams, subscriptions that are difficult to cancel, fees that might be deemed onerous, data breaches, and other practices deemed abusive, unfair, and generally considered to make New York less affordable. Would you encourage the governor to sign that bill, or do you think they should veto it? Because it would be an expansion of the attorney general's powers, since they'd be the one responsible for ultimately policing some of these issues if there are complaints made.
I don't think it's my job to be commenting on policymaking one way or the other. But in that particular instance, what I'll tell you is the concerns that I've heard from folks in the business community is that changing the language so that it's not just deceptive practices, but also abusive or unfair, sort of broadens the scope and expands the scope in a way that creates an unpredictable business climate, because deceptive may have a relatively settled meaning, but unfair or abusive may offer wider latitude. And so that's an example where I think the expansion can be problematic. Now, the challenge and the danger that ends up happening when you start to allow an office that's supposed to be focused on enforcing the law and you start to say, you know what, this is an office where you can do some policymaking, is you start to attract people that should probably be running for governor or the state legislature. And it becomes very tempting as a person who's in the office of attorney general leading the Department of Law to say, well, you know, there's this industry over here, and if I went after them, you know, it would be really popular with my base. And now I have this wider latitude to go after them. I just think it creates, incentives for abuse.
Republican New York Attorney General candidate Khurram Dara speaking with Public Radio's David Lombardo on the Capitol Press Room. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. The North Country Chamber of Commerce has unveiled a new campaign highlighting the longstanding bonds between Canada and the U.S. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley has more.
Canadian visits to the North Country region are down 30% over last year since President Donald Trump imposed tariffs and called for the Northern Nation to become the 51st state. The North Country Chamber of Commerce has since been working to reestablish relationships from cultural to trade. Officials on Monday introduced a We Know Canadians As campaign. This first phase highlights 9 ways Canada and the U.S. have supported each other for generations. North Country Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Gary Douglas emphasizes the initiative is not a marketing campaign.
Welcome to the launch of a celebration of our region's special friendship with Canada. We Know Canadians As. A heartfelt binational message honoring the deep people-to-people bonds they have long defined our relationship with our Canadian neighbors. This effort is not marketing. I can't stress that enough. This is not a marketing campaign. It is a sincere expression of remembrance, gratitude, and friendship at a moment when reaffirming our shared history matters more than it ever has in the past.
Douglas introduced a new bilingual video highlighting ties between Canada and the U.S.
For generations, communities in northern New York and in Quebec and Ontario to move through life together. We know Canadians not merely as neighbors, but as remarkable friends. An initial set of 9 examples are at the heart of this messaging. Each example reminds viewers that our unique connection with Canadians is built upon shared sacrifice, shared compassion, and shared humanity.
The video, which has no narration and relies on solemn music for its soundtrack, includes examples of Canadians volunteering in the U.S. Civil War and fighting together on the beaches of Normandy and the desert of Afghanistan, helping the CIA rescue American diplomats from Tehran in 1980 and sheltering travelers in Gander during 9/11.
We needed it to be emotive, and it was easy to be emotive because the relationship is so challenged and it's so special. And they don't believe anymore that we remember. If you're Canadians, we do remember. If you're Americans, please remember.
Chamber Vice President of Marketing Christy Kennedy explained that the video will initially be distributed on social media.
Social media, obviously, is the quickest way to get the message out and to reach the most people. So locally, we're going to really use the messaging of how intertwined we are and why this relationship is so important. We've also gave sneak peeks to the Consulate General as well as the Delegate General of Canada and Quebec, and they are on board to help us get this message out as well.
For Assemblyman Michael Cashman, a Democrat, the video is a powerful expression of the importance of the Canadian-U.S. relationship.
It's quite emotional, and I think it's very telling of the importance of the relationship between the United States and Canada. As a former town supervisor of border communities, I saw, you know, firsthand, locally, the impact. Everything from the loss of visitors at our golf courses to the impact on our hotels. But it's not just the economic impact. It's the social fabric that binds us together. Our two nations have a friendship that have been bound for generations.
SUNY Plattsburgh Center for the Study of Canada director Christopher Kirky interpreted the video as a heartfelt message reaching beyond the two nations' trade relationship.
Will it ultimately shake hearts and minds in a way that we hoped it will? I'm not sure. This is not aimed at a government-to-government level. So to the extent that average Canadians and Americans hear this, I think it's useful. It really is.
Again, Assemblyman Cashman.
I think this is just a tremendous way to thank our northern friends for not only their friendship, but how they've served alongside us in many respects.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
On a brisk morning earlier this week, National Guard members and veterans from the Capital Region loaded Christmas trees onto a FedEx truck at Elms Tree Farm in Ballston Spa. The trees were bound for military bases across the country and overseas as part of the Trees for Troops program.
That's a big one.
Trees for Troops began in 2005 as a collaboration between FedEx and the Christmas Spirit Foundation, the charitable branch of the National Christmas Tree Association. Since 2005, the program has donated more than 300,000 trees to bases in the U.S. and overseas. The Elms Tree Farm in Ballston Spa has been a part of the effort since its inception, and owner Garth Elms says that the program is a way to give back to troops for their service.
I mean, we're here enjoying our freedoms, and they're out there protecting our freedoms. So to give them a Christmas tree, to give them that sense of home, selfishly means a lot, and we'll continue to do it forever.
According to Elms, 17 farms, nurseries, and garden centers have donated trees, and more than 25,000 have been donated nationwide per year. Retired Colonel Richard Goldenberg, a member of the New York National Guard, has been a volunteer for Trees for Troops since 2006, and said that he was glad to see how much it has grown since then.
It's been sustained for well over 20 years, 21 years now, and it's really an indication of just how much community support there really is here in the Capital Region. You know, all of our communities have some ties to the military. You know, the Schenectady has the 109th Airlift Wing that flies to the South Pole every winter. The 42nd Infantry Division headquarters, which is over in Troy, they're currently deployed, and that was the unit I deployed with over 20 years ago.
Air National Guard member Elizabeth Felix is a first-time volunteer who said she was excited for the opportunity to contribute to the program, knowing how her friends who have been deployed miss home during the holidays.
It's such a hard time. I have friends who have been deployed, and Thanksgiving time, Christmas time, it's such a difficult time for them, being away from the family, and it's such a good thing to have this organization helping them, let them know that somebody's thinking of them.
Goldenberg also said that the program was a meaningful way to make service members deployed abroad feel at home.
You know, the holiday season means so many things to so many different people, but showing our support for those military families is probably the most important thing we can do.
This year's event comes days after the shooting of two West Virginia National Guard members in Washington, D.C. on November 26th, which killed 20-year-old specialist Sarah Beckstrom and injured 24-year-old Sergeant Andrew Wolf. The volunteers with Trees for Troops include veterans, retirees, and current service members from the Capital Region, and even those who received trees when they were deployed. Staff Sergeant Mitchell Mihalko, also a member of the Air National Guard, first participated in the program in 2021, and then received a tree when he was deployed overseas in Qatar in 2022.
Seeing both ends of it, being able to give one and then being able to receive one, I just thought it was really cool to know that not only can I help out my fellow service members, but knowing that they also care about me.
Mihalko said that getting the gift of the Christmas tree meant a lot to him and his fellow service members.
When I received it, it really just made me feel at home. You know, of course, being in the desert without any snow or trees, you don't really feel a Christmas spirit. But when you walk into that workplace and you see a tree there all decorated up, it really means a lot to us.
I'm Mariam Ahmed.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2549. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.